Oh, it's such an honor, Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
No, it's a pleasure. You're brilliant. You're a brilliant interviewer, man.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
I really liked your questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight, too.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you for your lovely review. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it. And, and it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Stevenson is an award-winning stand-up comedian and author. Offstage, Benjamin has worked for publishing houses and literary agencies in Australia and the USA. He currently works with some of Australia's best-loved authors at Curtis Brown Australia. Greenlight is his first novel. Jane Harper describes the novel as an outstanding debut, confident, compelling, with a surprise around every corner. I'm your host, Danny V. Welcome, Benjamin. I'm very much looking forward to chatting today about your novel, Green Light.
Thanks. Me too.
You might have seen from one of my posts on social media my response to your prologue in that it was terrifying. I was actually reading it in the dentist waiting room, so I think that doubled the terrifying feeling I had. But the imagery in this chapter was just so great. And I'm just going to read a bit without giving away any spoilers, of course. I loved this bit. She saw her blood-red footprints leading from the bed. Droplets sputtered from the roof, feeding the dark liquid monster that was consuming the floor, and long, almost black rivulets ran down all four walls. All a violent, cascading red, the walls were bleeding. It's probably my favourite part of the book. How did you come up with something like that?
I wanted to start really, really well, I think is the most predictable answer there. I mean, I know how important it is to start a book with something gripping and something unique and interesting. And so I just kind of had this image of effectively red running down the walls, which I think leads to a lot of suspense. And you're kind of wondering, because it's my first book, no one really knows what to expect. So I think people are kind of wondering, what is the rational explanation for this? Mm-hmm. Or is this something full on The Shining, walls are bleeding kind of thing? So I did just want it to be kind of to capture that kind of suspense as well. It's kind of a little mini mystery throughout the book is where she is and what that is, which kind of just pervades the first kind of third of the book. But I think I just wanted to set it up with something scary. I didn't think it was that scary, and everybody has told me it's very scary, so I was surprised by that.
I think I was putting myself in the shoes of the protagonist. I was like, oh, this is terrifying, and now the walls are bleeding, and I just need to keep reading this book, funnily enough.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's not a horror novel. It is a crime thriller novel, yeah. So it's interesting that I didn't mean it to be so scary, but I guess I wanted to start the tone. I think the tone of the book is fairly dark, and I think I wanted to really kind of set the tone, strap in. It's going to be tense from here, right from page one. So what better way to do it than bleeding walls?
Absolutely. I also think it was really good because we often don't hear from the victim. You know, we usually don't hear that perspective. We just hear about what happened. So I thought it was really interesting to get into the mind of that person that it was happening to.
Yeah, and I think that was a tricky decision for me because I think it's hard to do that well because you can't swap heads of your narrators and reveal things to the audience that the lead character doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So the book is kind of close third person on Jack, and I do switch around at the start of each section with little glimmers of other things. And it's kind of just for the reader, really. But I didn't want it to make it too invasive on what we could know that we're learning throughout the narrative. Otherwise, to be honest, it's kind of cheating. But I liked doing that kind of thing, especially with the victim, because the book is broken up into TV episodes. Mm-hmm. So it's season one, episode one is the start, and then season one, episode two. And at the start of each one, we kind of go backwards a little bit, and it's kind of like the way that there would be a cold open, which is the bit that plays before the credits,
yep,
in Law and Order or NCIS, and that's where you're allowed to use that different perspective to set up the story. So I thought that if I use that, it was kind of the excuse to swap heads. And, you know, it's kind of a, and that's what you missed on Glee, but it's kind of the crime joke version of that.
Now, you're also part of an award-winning stand-up comedy duo, but the novel Greenlight is, as we've mentioned, quite a dark crime thriller. Do you think that your personal experience, your sort of darkness and the comedy work really well together? Do you kind of need one to fuel the other?
Absolutely. I think that comedy is by nature quite dark. You have to tackle mm-hmm. quite difficult subjects in humorous ways. And so there's some really great comics that do really, really black stuff. My comedy is fairly lighthearted, but you still got to kind of go there sometimes. You've got to toe the line. You've got to push the audience's level of comfort in order to get the good response that you want, which in this case is laughter. So it was enjoyable to me kind of just letting that out of the cage and going whole hog on it. My editor did make me take a bunch of jokes out, but I still think I got a few witty lines in there here and there. So I'm pleased with that. But I think that comedy and crime writing, I was surprised by how similar they are because they both trade on suspense.
Mm-hmm.
So in comedy, you're building suspense and then you subvert the audience's expectations in order to get a laugh. So a boring joke might be something like, I was kicked out of school the other day, but I was the teacher. So that's the setup and the suspense is I was kicked out of school. Why were you kicked out of school? And then the punchline is reversing it. I was actually the teacher the whole time. Sorry, the full joke would be something like, I was kicked out of school for giving a student a wedgie. I was the teacher. And crime's the same. You're setting up the suspense, you're setting up the question, and then you're subverting the audience's expectations. The only difference is that you're not looking for a laugh. What you're looking for instead is, whoa, or wow, didn't see that coming. So it's kind of, yeah, it's very similar. I mean, we call the big sting, the big reveal of the killer, we just call that a punchline or a callback in comedy. So I actually really enjoyed using all of my narrative techniques from comedy in writing crime, and I think it actually made it a more complex, evenly laced crime novel where I'm lacing the clues through the novel because that's the way that you do jokes.
I love the way that you've compared comedy and crime writing in that way. I think that's really clever and really true because humour often comes from a satirically dark place, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, there's that old quote, which is, I think is it Chekhov? And he says, if there's a gun on the mantle in the first act, you have to fire it in the third act, which a lot of people kind of attach to comedy, mm-hmm. attach to crime writing. But I attach it to comedy because you've got to say something and lay the groundwork and then revisit it later in an hour-long comedy show. So often you're saying things 10 minutes in that you will not wait, you will only expand on at the end after 60 minutes. And if you see a great comedian, they might do a bit on elevators, and then at the end of their show, they might be stuck in an elevator, and all of the elevator stuff comes back circularly. So I think that it, technique-wise, I cling to that Chekhov's gun in comedy as well. But yeah, satire, darkness, like I say, pushing people to their comfort zones in order to establish a reaction is basically all that comedy is.
Now, talking about your writing process, which we've just touched on then, do you find that because writing a book is you alone, whereas I'm assuming your stand-up is more collaborative, how do you find that difference?
I loved it. In stand-up, I have to get every joke across my brother and his most tight-lipped, judgmental comedy critic that you will ever see, which is good because it drives us both to write. I do the same to him. It drives us both to write jokes that both of us find funny, which means that they're, in the end of the day, good jokes. But I really enjoyed every decision in this book is my decision, and I really enjoyed just telling the story that I wanted to tell, which I think comes across in the themes that I was interested in and dealing with in this book. So, yeah, I really enjoyed doing it on my own. That said, on my own, it was a very collaborative edit with my fantastic editor, Amanda, and my fantastic publishers, Kim and Bev, and they all contributed in significant ways. But I suppose the first draft all comes down to me. So, yeah, I really enjoyed having that space and that freedom. But comedy, then again, I only have to write half the jokes. So I wish somebody could have written half the book for me. It would save me a bit of time.
Just give your brother the second half and go, it's all yours. You write the second half.
It'd be so shit if he did it.
I love that. Just for our listeners, I just want them to appreciate the birds in the background. I'm really enjoying it. I feel like spring is definitely in the air, and I'm loving it. I really am. You're not outdoors, are you? Just have a window open?
They're going, no, it's the window's closed, so trying as best as I could to soundproof it, but they're going absolutely crazy in the tree outside. You can imagine that I'm sitting at a winery, if that helps.
Oh, that's great. I like that. Yeah, I was saying before that I spoke to someone in New York a few weeks ago and there was the traffic. So I'm liking the, you know, juxtaposition today of the birds. It's really nice.
Yeah, at least I don't have, well, traffic in New York plus swearing outside the window, probably mugging or two. Just adding the environment.
That would make a really interesting podcast. Now, the book also highlights the darker and more corrupt side of media. We have the sensationalist TV show and, of course, Jack's editing of the podcast, which shifts and shapes the interviewees and manipulates the context. Why was it important to explore this side of the media?
I was very interested in the way that kind of true crime is digested in our kind of sphere these days. And I think that I watched and I got addicted to all the good ones, Serial, Making a Murderer, The Jinx. And all I could think at the end of them was people were having these discussions of, do you think they're guilty? Do you think they did it? Or do you think they're innocent and they should be free? And I didn't have that feeling. The only feeling that I had at the end was that I wasn't sure that I had heard the whole story. So even if you're telling someone something that is right and true, and I think a good example is Michael Moore and his documentaries, because he deals with important subjects and he's dealing with essentially the truth. But the way he tells it, he still has to manipulate it to tell you the narrative that he wants. Now, then we move into more kind of ambiguous definitions of truth, and that is that the shows like Making a Murderer is basically petitioning that Stephen Avery is innocent or guilty, and they need to get that line across as much as they can. So after I finished that, I was really intrigued because the show did a good job of making it seem like he was innocent. So I went and I read the opposing side, Ken Kratz, who's the defense lawyer, and he is by no means a nice guy. He was turfed out of his office for abusing his power on a victim that he was supposed to be representing for domestic abuse. So I'm no way supporting Ken here, but I read his book and he illustrates some points in his book which the TV show clearly skipped over. And then there's other bits in which he just is kind of bragging or he's laying his own fictions. And then the TV show's rebuttal to those fictions is saying, well, in the book you skipped over this. So the only thing that I could be sure of out of everything that everyone was saying was that nobody was telling me the truth. So in the end, I don't know if he's innocent or guilty and I don't know how to land on that side. But they're still making these shows and basically social media has become a justice system in of itself for these killers with huge petitions and appeals. So it's kind of interesting. It was very interesting to me to get in the head of that, the documentary makers, and take it to the natural extremes, because I'm not saying that anyone did anything wrong. I'm just saying that they showed you what they needed to show you to make a TV show. But in my book, he actually commits a crime in order to get the ending to the TV show that he needs, and he covers up a piece of evidence that could swing the case either way. So when that killer gets out, it really puts it on Jack, my lead character, to set things right. And I was just interested in pushing that idea to the extreme that what we see on TV, even if it's sold as a hard fact documentary, it's not actually the truth, or it's not the truth the way that the truth could be presented.
And it's so important to consider when we are consuming our media, especially, like you say, the power of social media.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, it's the new kind of, it's social justice these days. People were not in the courtrooms of all of these subjects of the documentaries. We just weren't in it. And there's no way to kind of sum up 250 hours of court cases in a 10-hour television show and not leave some bits out. But it's so strong and people feel so strongly about it because they want to be seen to be doing the right thing and to be on the right side. And so people can really get personally invested in these true crime shows, and that makes them more communicative on social media and with each other about their own opinions being valued as part of the process, which is changing the way that I think that we're looking at justice in terms of appeals and things, which is, yeah, another interesting thing that I wanted to look at.
Yeah, it's really interesting the power of, a hashtag or someone behind, another person on social media. I see that on Twitter a lot. It's very political out there. And I was having this conversation with someone before, you're almost afraid to say what you think sometimes.
I guess it goes the other way too. Mm. I think that I'm talking about mainly, because the book is about the guilt of potentially releasing someone who might be a killer. But it goes the other way too, because our communication has changed so much that now the people that didn't used to have voices, because you just need a podcast and you just need an iPhone and you just need to hit upload. So something that's interesting is, say, like the O.J. Simpson's case. I think that, the media kind of controlled that case to get him off in the way that it was kind of rich and powerful people controlling the narrative. But these days, and we've seen a few new documentaries and reenactments and series kind of released about that case, these days it's quite easy for the victims, it's easier for the victims' families and people who are victims of any crime to get their own word out there, which I think is valuable as well. So while my book deals with someone that the question is whether he's truly guilty or not, I think that it is good in a lot of ways because victims who have been wronged from justice also get their voice out. It's just a sifting between them, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You're probably getting a better version of the truth, I guess, if you're hearing from many voices rather than the controlled one.
Yeah, exactly, which I think is the real key, that we do have those many voices and you are able to kind of plunge headfirst into them these days.
Now, I really enjoyed all the different parts of Jack Quick, our main protagonist, and all those things that made him who he was. Now, he suffers from a disorder that challenges stereotypes of what it is to be a man. Why was it important for you to explore this aspect of masculinity?
I think that Jack's character, he's very much about control. And I think that the illness he has, which is bulimia, there are very different reasons that many people can suffer from it. And I think for Jack, it does come down to control. And so the interesting thing for me is that the way that he controls the truth and the way that he controls the narrative in his show is kind of a metaphor for the way in which he's controlling his own self and his own body. And he's also got a disabled brother who's in a permanent vegetative state. And I think Jack's masculinity can't connect with his illness because of some PTSD as well to do with his brother. So it's all kind of tying up. I think it's in control, and I think it was very interesting to me to deal with what the way we look at masculinity in an illness that is normally a female illness. So there's a few bits in the book where I really kind of tackle that head on. He gets a flyer from a doctor and it says, so your daughter has an eating disorder. And his dad says, well, what is this? And they said, it's the only flyer that we have for bulimia. And so it's kind of, I was interested in tackling those stereotypes head on. And also Jack has to, he has this and it pervades his entire life and he has to get up every day and do his job and, put on that face and try as hard as he can to get through the day despite his illness. So I thought it was interesting to me to have that for him. And I also think I wanted him to be genuine and to struggle genuinely as well as the way it ties in with his kind of perspective and his life. I think it's very boring when our detectives in novels are just alcoholics or drug addicts or they smoke. And Jack's pretty clean cut, but he just has had a really tough time, particularly through his 20s, with this illness. And so it was interesting for me to look at him like that.
there is this very complex idea of Jack and his relationship with his brother. It's complex, and his feelings about what happened to his brother are complex also. Now, you're a twin. You have a twin brother. Did you draw on any of your real-life relationship with your twin brother? Because there are a lot of kind of real, raw feelings with Jack and his brother Liam.
Did I wish that my brother was in a permanent coma, are you asking me?
No, not at all. Not at all.
The feeling... I think that everything comes from that kind of core place. And when we talk about, I think an interesting thing about his brother, and I can't really say too much because some of the backstory is a bit of a spoiler, but again, I think it comes down to masculinity, and it's not, Jack's unable to really kind of accept either the love of his dad or the relationship that he has with his brother, in which he kind of can't really let it go. So he's always ringing his brother up and talking to him, and it's just this one-way conversation. So I think not so much anything specific, but I think we all have those kind of deep family urges and feelings and the way that we connect with people. And it was interesting to me to kind of remove that connection and wonder how that would affect a family. Because they are, I mean, the mum isn't in the book. She passed away when they were young. So it is, it's a very kind of stilted family in the way that they are able to communicate, and in which they're able to, would communicate with each other. And in fact, Liam can't communicate at all. So it's kind of just taking that, again, that next step further to kind of really examine its effect on Jack and his character.
I loved those conversations Jack had with him. It was really sad, but also, you know, it kept that relationship, even though it was one way, still breathing in a way.
Yeah, and it was great because I was able to write plot exposition into Jack explaining things to his unconscious brother. And therefore, I didn't have to have pages and pages of exposition. So,
brilliant.
Very clever move by my editor there suggesting that.
Excellent writing process tip. Mm. Now, the book explores the idea of guilt. I mean, on the front cover, it says everyone's guilty of something. And this guilt drives people to do things they may not have done without it. Guilt is definitely a driving force for our protagonist, Jack, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole book is about guilt and regrets, really. And that's why it's called Greenlight, because Greenlight in TV is when you greenlight an episode or a production, that's go. That's, we've got the funding and we're making it. And so I was kind of just interested in kind of, once you cross that point, how do you redeem yourself? Where does that guilt kind of fester inside you? And, so it is. It's about regrets. And it's about Jack accepting the regrets and the guilt that he has a part of. But I think in as well, I'm talking this up as kind of a character-fueled novel, but it is a pacey mystery. Trust me, listeners. It's a thrill ride. As well, I think that Alexis, one of the characters, she mentions about guilt not being guilt. She says that he feels guilty. And she doesn't believe him because she thinks that what he has is grief, and that what guilt really is, when you get down to it, it's actually you grieving the fact that you aren't as good a person as you thought you were. So it's kind of Jack getting taken down a few pegs and then starting from the bottom and, deciding to solve this murder himself so that effectively he can redeem himself, but so that that old version of himself that he keeps in his head can be aligned again.
Absolutely. And look, the book is very suspenseful and there are very many, many reveals that surprised me as well. And I will ask you about your writing process. I imagine that's quite challenging because you don't want to reveal things too soon, but you need to kind of do some foreshadowing throughout. Are you a plotter? Are you a pantser? Or how did you make sure that these reveals were revealed at the correct time?
That's a good question. It was tricky. It's always tricky knowing when to do certain things and also how many twists you can really pack into a novel. So I think there's three big ones in my book, and the way that I spaced them out was very tricky to make sure that the pacing stays suspenseful and that also that the book is still moving in a way that people are enjoying reading it. I think in terms of plotter or pantser, I think I'm a general plotter but a bit of a pantser. So I had the end, and I had all my characters. So I think if you can plot your characters, then they can kind of start to talk to you. So the big mid-book twist, I didn't know I was going to do that until I realized I'd written myself in a corner and I realized I'd kind of inadvertently put all the pieces in. So not to give it away, but yeah, the one that happens around the middle, kind of the first revelation that we have. So that was interesting. And then I think it's about each twist having its own power. So you need to fully develop it so that people are happy that whenever you're twisting it, that they feel satisfied that that's told a complete story, and then you twist it again. So what's really bad is when you're reading a novel and there's the, oh, the killer is this person, and then the person goes, all right, so that's the not the killer, and now we wait for the real killer. So I feel like you need to have it be fully, and that's just because of the way that we read books. Like, I think you just know the structure. You might be reading a book and there's 50 pages left in your hand. And so if there's 50 pages left, you know, all right, if this is the killer, it's going to be really boring in 50 pages, so I'm waiting for something else. So you kind of have to play, it's almost fourth wall breaking, but you kind of have to play with the way that readers read novels as well and know where they are on the page and how they're taking it in where you put your twist. So it's actually, it's really tricky. And also you want to keep those cliffhangers coming and keep them burning through. I think about a third of the way from the end of my novel, I think I like to think that I structured it like every chapter you can't, a little bit more gets revealed and then you just can't stop. So you've got to go to the end to really get the full kind of pack. And I probably did about 12 of those chapters in a row just to rifle through the end of the novel so that you're always coming back.
Yeah, because the pace quickens towards the end too. And I guess that has to be a conscious choice as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very... Yeah, you want people to speed through the end. I think the pace at the start for part one is quite quick as well. Mm-hmm. And then Jack has to get out to the town that he's doing the investigation in. So I kind of slow it down again and put all the pieces together. And then, I mean, I really think that great books or great thrillers, they're all about setting people up in a perfect way and then literally knocking over the chessboard. So I think... Yeah, I set my pieces in the middle of the novel rather than at the start because the start is such a flurry and, there's the girl with the bloody walls and then there's the court case and you've got to whip through the TV show and then you've got to get the killer out of jail and then you've got to get the new victim. And so it's like it's all tearing through that bit. And then I kind of calm it down while Jack deals with his own guilt over that and I reset the pieces on the chessboard so I can knock it over again, really.
Now, it was set in, wine country with vineyards and wineries. Did you have to do much research on this kind of jargon and how they go about producing their wine, or was this something you knew about before?
Not something I knew about before. I mean, I certainly drink a lot of wine.
That's research, right?
But I'm by no means an expert. So, yeah, it's a tax deduction for next year.
Excellent.
Tax, which is why I wrote the book about wine.
Yeah, hot tip for our writers.
Yeah. Next year it'll be about a trip to New York and restaurants.
Fantastic.
I did have to do a lot of research. I think that for me though, research is it's an aid. It's not something that you need it to make the book great, but I always used it to add to what I was doing. I never started from a point of research in that I would write it the way that I needed it to be. And then I would look up the facts. And if I couldn't find anything that worked, then I would change the story a little bit so that it worked with the facts. Or I would, it's like hunting through doctors for different opinions. Like if I can find something close enough that gets what I need it to do, it's like this doesn't happen in the novel, but if someone got poisoned and they foamed at the mouth, then I would just write the scene and then I would Google what poison causes foaming at the mouth and then I would use that poison rather than... looking up poisons first and then choosing one, for example. So that's kind of the way I did it. That's kind of the way I did it with the wine. I mean, I've been to a lot of country towns, particularly wine-based country towns, so I kind of had the image of everything. And then the jargon, I mean, I kind of just set my characters and took their own vibes to kind of come up with a bit of it. And lots of people have said that it's really accurate of wine country, so particularly Curtis as an imposter and everything. So... that kind of stuff just came from what I wanted my characters to be like. But I think I must have been around enough people that it's soaked in across my life.
Soaked in. I like that pun too. It's great.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Now, I thought there was a lot of truth. I find quotes in books and I just, you know, love them and want to talk about them. And there's something that Jack says about perceptions. And he says, the opera house's supposedly pristine white sails were rust dark with stains. Just like people themselves, the nuts and the bolts of them, the traumas and the bruises. Everyone likes the final product, but no one wants to see it close enough to know how it's all stitched together. Sad but true quote, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we were talking about before with the TV show. I think it's if you see how the sausage is made and you see that the concessions were made behind the scenes, then you're not going to like it as much. I mean, and then Jack himself as a person, when you tear him apart throughout the novel and kind of look inside him, it's darker than the face that he's able to put on every day. So it's interesting in that. There's a great documentary by Louis Theroux. I don't want to lower the tone of your podcast, but where he goes behind the scenes when they're making adult films.
I've seen that one.
it's just hilarious how businesslike they are and how unsexy it is. And so I think that, it's just kind of when you tear away everything. And I was having a drink at the Opera House when I thought of that passage and at the key bar, and I was just looking at it and I was thinking, this is, you know, it's gorgeous, it's on postcards, but wow, it looks like shit. It's all this crappy bits, there's bits falling off. I mean, you look at the bridge as well, it's all just steel and beams, and you know, they're just these beautiful pieces that also are just things whacked together.
I love that. I really do. And that documentary, I watched that a few years ago and I remember that. It sticks clearly in my mind. And look, I have no problem with lowering the tone of the podcast. That's totally fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'll keep it at gutter level then.
Keep it. We'll just go there now. Look, I always love hearing about the publishing process, and it seems to be unique for everyone. Now, you've worked for publishing houses and literary agencies in Australia and the US. You're currently working with other Australian authors at Curtis Brown. This must be an incredible learning experience for you whilst writing. So what was your publishing experience?
It was crazy. I mean, the thing that this has taught me is to be more empathetic with my authors, because I understand how hard it is when someone tells you that your ending doesn't work or that this character is no good or whatever. So I've kind of got a renewed... I'm always nice to them, don't get me wrong, but I've kind of got a renewed patience for writers and understanding what they're going through when they're really beating their head against the desk working on a new novel. And my process, it was interesting, because I've worked on a lot of people's books and I really, really loved thrillers, and I was really kind of working on some great ones and we were doing really, really nicely with them. So, and I was very pleased with that. I was, editorially, I was really, really enjoying it. And then I thought, you know, maybe I enjoy working on other people's books, but maybe I'd enjoy trying to write my own. So I just wanted to write something fun and exciting and something that would keep me up at night. So I wrote a book, and basically there were a few kind of rounds of publishing interest. And one of my colleagues actually came on as my agent, which was fantastic. And she kind of helped me set it all up. And in the end, we had a couple of meetings with a few houses, and we had a meeting with Penguin Random House, who said that they loved it and that there was no way in hell that they could publish it. Because the book that I wrote that I'm talking about was a different book, and it had a bit of a genre twist. It was a murder mystery, and it had a little bit of time travel in it, which is just not something that sells or markets. And as a literary agent, I should have known that. But I was just trying to write something fun and just for me. And I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't really thinking about that. I just wanted to write the funnest novel possible. So basically, I wrote that first novel and it was rejected by everybody. And then Penguin said, but we really like the writing. So what else have you got? And the answer was nothing. But the answer that I gave them was, oh, sure, I got heaps of ideas. I'll send you something in a couple of weeks. So I went home and I bashed out the first third of Greenlight and I sent it to them. And then from there, we were on board and they said that they would pick it up and they'd be happy to publish it as my debut novel, which is interesting because I don't think in my entire career I have seen an Australian publisher buy fiction on a sample. So they must have liked it a fair bit, which was good. And then once I had the contract in hand, I had the rest of the year to finish it. So this book probably took about 8 months to write. But the whole process, probably 2.5 years, if we consider the book that's sitting in my desk drawer, that I'm very thankful for because it got me the yeah, got me the nudge up in order to get this one up, which I'm very proud of.
And so many authors reveal that they have written this one book and someone called it their apprenticeship, never got published, which led them to something else. It's like this kind of magic story that you have to write this first manuscript that's never going to get published, and then, you know, you do it.
Yeah, I mean, lots of people don't have to, must be lovely for them. But I think it's a big learning curve putting together 100,000 words for a book. And, you know, halfway through writing Greenlight, I was constantly thinking, this isn't as good as the one that I had. I was really proud of the one I had. I thought it was all that I could offer. But the learning process is actually that to accept that, no, you are better and it has made you better. And at the end of the day, I was able to look at Greenlight and go, phew, I'm glad this is my debut novel and not that other piece of junk that I churned out before. So, yeah, I think having that, I call it a graveyard of words, I think that having that really, really helps you excel when you put the I'm trying to think of the metaphor here. It's got something to do with the axe to the mill, but I can't think of the words that are coming to my head. But the other thing about it is I think it teaches you that you have to really want to write a novel, because lots of people want to write a novel, and that's great, and everyone has a story to tell, and that's great too. But if you told everyone that wrote a novel, yeah, you have to write a novel, and then you have to write another novel in order to get the one published, I think it kind of steals you, and it makes you know that this is what I want to do, and this is how I'm going to professionally approach this, because it kind of really, the first novel is all inspiration and fire and you write it late at night and you write it in the morning, but the second novel is business, you know, you're writing it because you want this to be your job, and some of the excitement can kind of, that muse can kind of disappear because you've already written that first novel, you've already done it the first time, so the shine's taken off it. But it's really valuable because then you're able to settle yourself and look at it particularly objectively and know that this is what you're meant to be doing and this is what you love doing.
I love the idea of a graveyard of words. I think that's great.
Yeah, you've got to pile them up. I think I wrote another crappy book in high school, which probably, I thought it was a book at the time, but it was probably only 30,000 words or something. So everything adds to your graveyard. I think someone said you have to write
A million words? Yeah.
Which is 10 books. And then the other thing is the classic 10,000 hours of anything will make you a...
expert.
Yeah, an expert.
Yes, I like the million words. It seems impossible, but I think, I think most writers have kind of done that and not even realised.
Yeah, text messages, do they count?
Why not? What's next for you? More comedy, another book, both?
Both. So I do a comedy tour every year. If any of you listeners are interested, it's the Stevenson Experience. We do musical comedy. So we do a tour every year throughout all of Australia and also Edinburgh. So we just got back from Edinburgh 2 weeks ago. So I now have to write the 2019 show, which will debut in February. So I've got about 7 months to do that. And Penguin have also, which is brilliant, they've signed me up for 2 more books. So there'll be a book a year from me until 2020. So the next 2 years in September at the same time. So I will be working on the next book of mine as well, which is due in January. So I will be writing comedy and writing books for the next 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, and putting it together for the next one, which is great.
Yeah, wonderful.
And also, Greenlight will be published in the UK and the US in September next year as well. So I'll be doing the US edits on those. So it's a pretty jam-packed couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely look out for the Stevenson Experience when it comes to Sydney next year.
Yeah, we come to the Sydney Comedy Festival every year, so it's a fun one. We like it.
Yeah, no, I'll have to check that out. And look, crime fiction, when you say that it's being published in UK and US, like crime fiction and thrillers, especially from Australian authors, are just going bananas, aren't they? They're just going crazy. They're so popular right now.
Yeah, it's going really well. And I think, I mean, obviously we've all got Jane Harper to thank for that. She's absolutely brilliant at what she does. But her books have really kind of put the commercial front on Australian crime fiction and really kind of taken it to the world. And so I think there's a bit of a renaissance going on at the moment. I think we just have really good writers, and Australia lends itself to a lot of stories because it's so big and there's so infinite possibilities of where you can go. They're all, you know, we have snow and we have sun. You can kind of span out any small town and it'll be what it is. And then we also have the urban landscapes as well, so Sydney and Melbourne, where stories can be set. And we've got such a melting pot of people that it's very interesting to kind of tackle it. But I think that overall, yeah, we're having a bit of our own Scandi Noir, is the genre that they called when The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo took off, which is Scandinavian Noir, and you kind of saw a lot of books around them, which was all about trudging through the snow and solving grisly crimes, blood in the snow, that kind of thing. And then now Australia, we've got our own, I think it's called Southern Cross Noir. I read it in an industry trade. I don't know. I don't write it. Yeah, what about Bogan Noir or something? Oh,
that would sell for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, definitely a renaissance, definitely a lot of demand for this kind of gritty Australian fiction, and we just have such good writers, and I'm really pleased that it's back in the limelight, because even when I was, before I was an author, I was working in publishing and I was always keen to work on the thrillers, but publishing houses were telling me that, oh, we don't really do many thrillers, they don't really work. And 5 years later, they're working again, so we're kind of in the right, a golden age almost. I know, I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, me too. Must have been pretty cool to have Jane Harper write a little review on the back of your book.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, she's just the loveliest, and she asked for a copy, and I was happy to send it to her, and she had really nice things to say, which was, yeah, she's absolutely divine, Jane, and I can't recommend her books enough. But yeah, it was very lovely of her to put a quote on my cover. I think, yeah, I got a lot of really nice feedback from writers as well, because I work with them every day.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of pressure on, oh, this better not be shit, otherwise good luck me telling them that had to fix things in their book on Monday at work if they hate it. But I got a really, really good response from a lot of people. And yeah, it was it's one of those moments where, yeah, Jane sent through her kind words and you kind of step back and go, oh, wow, okay, this is real. And, I, you know, this bit of unbelieving that is happening to you, is that kind of happened there.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Benjamin. I really enjoyed Greenlight. I powered through it in a couple of days because after that, you know, first prologue, I couldn't get enough. And, you know, like I said, I just can't get enough of Australian crime fiction and thrillers at the moment. So it's been fantastic. But once again, thank you so much for your time today.
No worries. And thanks for reading it. Can I ask you, did you pick the ending?
I picked it probably about, there wasn't that many pages left, probably maybe 70 to 100 pages. I thought, oh, I think I know. And well, you know, I guess when I was speaking to, I think it was Sarah Bailey about hers, and, you know, you kind of can't just pick a random person to be, you know, the person who you're going to reveal. So it has to be someone in your mind, you know. So I didn't think I was that clever. I thought that you would set it up cleverly.
Yeah, I think if people piece it together nicely, close-ish to when you pull it out on the page, then that's a success for me. If you picked it on page 3, I'd be very disappointed.
No, and, you know, through those, you know, 70 pages or whatever, you don't know if you're right, obviously. So that keeps you reading. And in the end, you're like, oh, yeah, but obviously you'd set that up, because you don't just pick a random person to be the killer, or that's going to just undermine everything that you've written, right?
Yeah, they're all aliens. Everyone did it, which is actually Murder on the Orient Express. Sorry, spoiler warning.
Spoiler alert. But no spoilers for Greenlight. So highly recommend to listeners to grab that if they haven't already read it. But thank you so much again for your time, Benjamin. It was a pleasure.
No worries. Thanks for chatting to me.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.